Let's read the Heart Sutra together. And then we'll have a couple of minutes of silence, and then I'll teach it. Thus I have heard, at one time the Blessed One was dwelling Rajgira on Mass Vulture's Mountain together in one method with a great assembly of monks and a great assembly of bodhisattvas. At that time the Blessed One was absorbed in the concentration of the countless aspects of phenomena called profound illumination. At that time also the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, was looking perfectly at the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom, perfectly looking at the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates also. Then, through the power of the Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said to the severe Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, the gray being, how should a child of the lineage train who wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom? Thus he spoke, and the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, replied to the Venerable Shariputra as follows. Shariputra, whatever son or daughter of the lineage wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom, should look perfectly like this, subsequently looking perfectly and correctly at the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates also. Form is empty, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form also is not other than emptiness. Likewise, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, like this, all phenomena are merely empty, having no characteristics. They are not produced and do not cease. They have no defilement and no separation from defilement. They have no decrease and no increase. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. There is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no form, no sound, no smell, no taste, no tactile object, no phenomena. There is no I element and so forth, up to no mind element, and also up to no element of mental consciousness. There is no ignorance and no exhaustion of ignorance, and so forth, up to no aging and death, and no exhaustion of aging and death. Likewise, there is no suffering, origin, cessation, or path, no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and abide in the perfection of wisdom. Their minds have no obstructions and no fear. Passing utterly beyond perversity, they attain the final state beyond sorrow. Also, all the Buddhas who perfectly reside in the three times, relying on the perfection of wisdom, become manifest and complete Buddhas in the state of unsurpassed, perfect and complete enlightenment. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the equal to the unequal mantra, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, since it is not false, should be known as the truth. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is proclaimed, Tayata gate gate paragate parasamgate bodhisoha. Shariputra, a bodhisattva, a great being, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like this. Then the Blessed One arose from that concentration and said to the superior Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva, the great being, that he had spoken well. Good, good, O child of the lineage, it is like that. Since it is like that, just as you have revealed, the profound perfection of wisdom should be practiced in that way, and the Tathagatas will also rejoice. When the Blessed One had said this, the Venerable Shariputra, the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, and that entire assembly of disciples, as well as the worldly beings, gods, humans, demigods, and spirits, were delighted and highly praised what had been spoken by the Blessed One. And let's also do the homage to Manjushri on page 7. It's Manjushri is the Buddha of wisdom, so going to need some of that to understand this. Obeisance to my guru and protector Manjushri, who holds to a heart a scriptural text symbolic of a seeing all things as they are, whose intelligence shines forth like the sun, unclouded by delusions or traces of ignorance, who teaches in 60 ways like the loving fashion of a father for his only child, all creatures taught in the prison of samsara, confused in the darkness of their ignorance, overwhelmed by their suffering. You, whose dragon thunder-like proclamation of Dharma arouses us from the stupor of our disturbing attitudes and frees us from the iron chains of our karma, who wields the sword of wisdom, hewing down suffering wherever its sprouts appear, clearing away the darkness of ignorance. You, whose princely body is adorned with 112 marks of a Buddha, who has completed the stage, achieving the highest perfection of a Bodhisattva, who has been pure from the beginning, I bow down to you, O Manjushri, with the brilliance of your wisdom, O compassionate one. Illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind. Enlighten my intelligence and wisdom so that I may gain insight into the Buddha's words and the texts that explain them. Due to the fact that we're overwhelmed by our ignorance, that we then generate many disturbing attitudes that create karma, that create the experiences that we find ourselves in. And to develop a determination to free ourselves from that ignorance, which is the root cause of all the confusion we're in, and recognizing that everybody else is in exactly the situation, then develop the wish, wanting to free them from that suffering as well and bring them to happiness. And therefore willing to engage in all the practices to become a Buddha so that we can benefit others most effectively. So, actually, the teachings on the Heart Sutra start off talking about the meaning of the title, because the title is actually given in Sanskrit. It isn't included in our copy here. But the Sanskrit title, excuse my Sanskrit pronunciation, Bhagavati Prajnaparamita Hridaya, and it translates into, it means the essence of the perfection of wisdom, the Blessed Mother. And so the purpose of having the Sanskrit title first is first to show that this is an authentic teaching of the Buddha, and it was translated from the original Sanskrit. In other words, it wasn't made up by somebody else later on. And it also reminds us of the kindness of the translators who, you know, bothered to translate it from Sanskrit into Tibetan, and now from both Sanskrit and Tibetan into English. Okay. Essence of the perfection of wisdom, the Blessed Mother. Here when it says perfection of wisdom, Prajnaparamita, I often translate instead of perfection of wisdom, the far-reaching attitude of wisdom. Here we'll just use the word perfection because it's kind of a common one, but it's synonymous with what I usually say, the far-reaching attitude of wisdom. So this perfection of wisdom or far-reaching attitude of wisdom, there's the actual perfection of wisdom and then the textual perfection of wisdom. So the actual perfection of wisdom is what we want to develop okay? Because the actual perfection of wisdom is a wisdom that realizes emptiness conjoined with the bodhicitta. And so that's what leads us to enlightenment. So within the actual perfection of wisdom, there's two types. One is the causal perfection of wisdom, and that's the wisdom realizing emptiness of the bodhisattvas. Okay, so the bodhisattvas, those beings who have generated bodhicitta spontaneously and are still progressing on the path towards Buddhahood, their wisdom realizing emptiness is called the causal perfection of wisdom. The resultant perfection of wisdom is the wisdom realizing emptiness of a Buddha, a fully enlightened being, because that's the result we get. And that is also synonymous with the wisdom truth body, or the jhana dharmakaya, when we talk about the different bodies of the Buddha. Okay. Then the textual perfection of wisdom. This isn't an actual perfection of wisdom, because it's referring to the scriptures that reveal the actual perfection of wisdom. Okay, so the scriptures like the Heart Sutra, like all the, there's a whole series of perfection of wisdom sutras. These are the textual perfection of wisdom, okay, so-called because they teach us how to generate the actual one. So the Buddha is taught in the textual perfection of wisdom. We have the one that's in 100,000 stanzas, then another version that's 25,000 stanzas, another version that's 8,000 stanzas, and kind of the shortest condensed version is the Heart Sutra here. Okay, it kind of has the essence of all those, the big texts of the Prajnaparamita. Sometimes the words perfection of wisdom can also refer to emptiness itself. And I remember somewhere it being called like the natural perfection of wisdom, because that's the nature of all things. Okay, so this text is also called the essence, you know, the Heart Sutra, the heart, it's called the heart or the essence, because it contains in just, you know, a very few pages the meaning of, for example, the Prajnaparamita scripture in 100,000 verses. Okay, so it's the essence or the heart of it. And it also is called the Blessed Mother, which isn't a good English translation of the Tibetan or the Sanskrit term, but there is no good English translation, so what to do? The Sanskrit term is Bhagavati. The Tibetan term is Chomden Dema. Okay, so if you analyze this word, you know, why called the Blessed Mother, and this is relating to Tara also, yeah, is Chom, the first word in the Tibetan, is means to destroy. So here it's to destroy what we call the four negative forces or the four maras. Okay, so to destroy death under the influence of disturbing attitudes and karma, to destroy the five aggregates, our body and mind that are under the influence of disturbing attitudes and karma, to destroy the disturbing attitudes. Okay, that's the third one. And then the fourth one, the fourth mara, fourth negative force, is called the Son of Gods, which are certain beings in the God realms that make problems for practitioners. Okay, so the death. Yeah, so we have death, the five aggregates, the disturbing attitudes, and the Son of the Gods. Okay, so Chom in Chomden Dema, which is Bhagavati, means to destroy. Okay, so a Buddha is somebody who's destroyed everything that needs to be destroyed. Then the word Den in Tibetan means to possess or to be endowed with. So a Buddha is somebody who possesses or is endowed with all the good qualities. And then day means transcend. So it's indicating that a Buddha has transcended or gone beyond suffering. And then the word ma is a female term. Okay, it indicates, it means mother, so it indicates the female. And the Prajnaparamita is associated with the female because often the female represents wisdom. Okay, the male, like in the Tantra, when you have the male and female deity in union, the male represents the method side of the path, the female the wisdom side of the path. So here, the wisdom realizing emptiness, okay, and emptiness itself are both called mother. And why are they called mother? Because it's from them that the Buddhas are born. Okay? That the Aryas are born. So it's the same with Tara. Yeah, why is Tara called mother? Not because she had a bunch of kids, you know, yelling and screaming, but because, you know, Tara is the wisdom that realizes emptiness, and that wisdom that realizes emptiness gives birth to the various kinds of noble ones or superior beings. So the hearers who have realized emptiness, the solitary realizers who have realized emptiness, the bodhisattvas who have realized emptiness, and then the Buddha superior. So we talk about four kinds of Aryas. Yeah, the hearer, the solitary realizer, the bodhisattva, and the Buddha. So those are all beings who have realized emptiness directly. So the ma is indicating that the wisdom realizing emptiness is what gives birth to somebody who becomes a superior being who has direct perception of reality. Okay? So you can see in this symbolism, it has nothing to do with ordinary women, does it? You know? And similar, you know, when you talk about the male aspect in the Tantra, has nothing to do with ordinary men. Sorry, folks. Because the whole purpose is to get us out of being ordinary, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, the whole purpose is to get us so we're not attached to these garbage bodies that, you know, keep on having so much suffering. So that's why it has nothing to do with, you know, ordinary men, ordinary women who have, you know, garbage diluted bodies. I mean, isn't our body garbage diluted? Isn't it? Yeah. I mean, what does our body do? I mean, it basically produces all sorts of yucky stuff that none of us like. Isn't it? Yeah. I mean, we are in this whole thing, the body is beautiful, da 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 da. Anything all you do is open the skin, you know, yuck. Everything that comes in contact with our body, we consider dirty afterwards. You know, and who wants to be attached to this body, especially at the time of death? If we're attached to this thing, you know, when we're dying, it's bad news because we have no choice but to leave it. Yeah? And once it's a corpse, who's attached to it? Anyway, so, you know, the purpose is to get us out of being attached to something that's under the influence of disturbing attitudes and karma. Doesn't mean our body's evil and sinful. It just means that there's nothing here to be attached to, is there? Is there something in your body to be attached to? Oh, my intestine, it's so beautiful. Oh, my esophagus, I love it. Come on. Okay, then in the text they go into the homage of the translators. So they pay homage to the Prajnaparamita, the blessed mother. Okay, so again, Prajnaparamita refers to principally to the resultant Prajnaparamita, the wisdom realizing emptiness of the Buddha. And it implicitly refers to the textual and the causal Prajnaparamita. And then also, we take the Prajnaparamita and personify it so that there's a deity called Prajnaparamita, who's golden in color. Yeah, so there's a whole deity called Prajnaparamita, who's simply the symbolic representation of, you know, in form of something which itself is formless. Because the wisdom realizing emptiness doesn't have color and shape and all these things. Yeah, so, I mean, even Tara is an appearance of the wisdom realizing emptiness in order to communicate with our minds. Because our minds are so stuck on form and color and things like that, that the Buddhas appear in symbolic ways in order to communicate with us. Okay? So now let's get into the sutra itself. Okay? So we've done the title and the translator's homage. Okay, so the sutra starts out, "Thus have I heard." Okay, so this is the part of the text that was spoken by Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant for many, many years, and he heard most of the teachings, the sutra teachings that the Buddha gave. So when they had the council after the Buddha passed away, then Ananda recited all the sutras. So of the three baskets, you know, the Vinaya, the Sutra, and the Abhidharma baskets, Ananda recited the sutras because he had heard them. So when it says, "Thus I have heard," this is what Ananda's telling us that he heard. Okay? And this is all considered to be the Buddha's word because the Buddha inspired Ananda to say what he heard. And when we get on in the text, the whole text is basically a conversation between Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara. And so even though the Buddha didn't say very much, except "well done" at the end, this is considered the Buddha's word because the Buddha inspired this whole thing to happen. Okay? It was the Buddha's inspiration that made Shariputra ask the question and Avalokiteshvara to answer it. Okay, so the speaker of the sutra is actually Shakyamuni Buddha, okay? Because he was the one behind it. That's why I said it's all the Buddha's words. Now, there's different ways of looking at Shakyamuni Buddha. Some people say he was enlightened, you know, 2,500 years ago under the Bodhi tree. Another way of looking at the Buddha is that actually this mind stream that became Shakyamuni Buddha actually was enlightened a long time ago. They say eons ago in a pure land called Adorned with Peace and Flowers, and he was enlightened in the form of a Buddha called Muni Vairochana. Okay? And so he was enlightened at that time, but then went through this whole thing of appearing on our earth and, you know, growing up in the palace and leaving it and searching teachers and so on and so forth. That he went through all that thing as a way of setting an example for us and demonstrating what needs to be done to actually become a Buddha. Okay, so there's different ways of looking at the Buddha. Yeah, some say, "Oh, he's just enlightened here, that time, that place." Other people say, "No, he's actually enlightened before, but he did this whole thing as a way of instructing us." And it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, in the same way, like when you're a parent, you know, sometimes to teach your kids things, you pretend to discover things that you already know, but it's a skillful way to teach your kid. So similar. Okay. So the Buddha was the actual speaker. At the time that this sutra was given, it says at one time. So that one time was a time where the Buddha went to Rajgira after he had been in Vaishali. And so he was 57 years old at the time. He attained enlightenment when he was, I think, 35. He passed away when he was 81. So when he had been in Vaishali, he had been challenged by these non-Buddhists to this contest of miracle powers. And it was because of that, you know, he defeated them in this context of miracle powers, that then we have one of those four special days, which is in the first lunar month, the full moon. Remember? That's the day His Holiness usually starts teaching in the Mullum teachings in India. Okay, so it was after that time in Vaishali, then he went to Rajgir, and some of you have been to Rajgir, Vulture's Peak. Okay, it's in India, it's a mountain. You can now take a cable car up to the top. The actual place where the sutra was spoken is a little bit down. It's a flat area. It's not a terribly big area. But when you actually read this, it was, you know, there were like a great assembly of monks and a great assembly of bodhisattvas. You know, it was like, you know, when you look at the actual physical place, there weren't room for all these people. But, you know, not all of them were necessarily sitting on the ground because you had these high-level bodhisattvas who just kind of appeared in space. Okay? I mean, when you've realized emptiness, you don't need a chair to sit on. It's nice because then you can come to teachings at the last minute. Not worry about getting a seat. Okay, so the Buddha was, or the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajgira on Mass Vulture's Mountain. So it's there's different interpretations of the name, but the thing is, to ordinary people, it appeared to be a mountain that had a mass of vultures on it. But for people with very pure vision, the vultures were actually bodhisattvas. So it was bodhisattvas manifesting as vultures, okay? And to whom the sutra was given was to a great assembly of monks and a great assembly of bodhisattvas. I'm sure there were some nuns in there too. Okay? And it says, together in one method, okay? Together in one method with a great assembly of monks and a great assembly of bodhisattvas. Together in one method could mean, method means like conduct, so it could be that the conduct of listening to the teachings, that they were all listening to the teachings in the same way with great attentiveness, or it could be the method or conduct of them all meditating and focusing on emptiness together. So they were all, you know, focused together, doing this together, learning, okay? So that was to whom the sutra was given. Okay, so now we start.
I would interpret that as meaning that they were of the pure path. Is that true, or did they have monks?
Yeah, well, sometimes, you know, when they say monks, it's referring to the people on the hearers, the solitary realizer path. But then you have a lot of bodhisattvas who were monastics also. Okay, so it wasn't necessarily. And I think that these ones here were probably ones who had some bodhicitta realization. That's my guess. Because even, Shariputra, for example, he appears as, you know, kind of a regular arhat. You know, that's his appearance. But then there's another way of looking at him, that he's actually a bodhisattva who's appearing as an arhat, because it's a skillful means to have the appearance of arhats. You know, because sometimes for some people, depending on their disposition, arhats inspire them more than bodhisattvas do. Okay, so if you're a bodhisattva, you're a Buddha, you can appear as whatever you need to inspire beings. Okay, so what was going on? Now we start the, that was talking about like the common explanation of the background, you know, what everybody saw, what everybody heard. Now we're going to start with the uncommon explanation of the background, what was going on. So it says at that time, also the superior Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva, the great being, was looking perfectly at the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom, perfectly looking at the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates also. Okay, so this is uncommon because it wasn't readily apparent to all the people present what was going on. So this profound illumination that the Buddha was meditating on, okay? Yeah, because it says just the paragraph above. At that time, the Blessed One was absorbed in the concentration of the countless aspects of phenomena called profound illumination. Okay? So the Buddha is sitting there meditating. During the whole sutra, Buddha is sitting there meditating. Okay? That's what it looks like on the outside. What's actually going on, why it's called the concentration on profound illumination, is because the Buddha was focused single-pointedly on on emptiness, okay, on the nature of reality. And while he's doing this, his body is radiating incredible, brilliant light that fills the whole world, okay? And this light purified the environment. It purified all the sentient beings' minds. It caused the seeds on the sentient beings' minds to ripen. Okay, so people may have created some good karma in the past, put good seeds in their mind. With the Buddha radiating all this light, it causes those seeds to ripen, thus making the people's minds much more receptive for the teaching which was about to occur. So even though the Buddha was sitting there radiating this brilliant light, filling the environment, purifying the sentient beings, only the people with high realization could see what was going on. The rest of the people there were just, you know, they just saw Buddha sitting there meditating. So this is actually something to think about, because, you know, we go and listen to His Holiness teach. We see, you know, some guy with glasses sitting there coughing. You know, we don't know what's really going on. Yeah, I mean, there could be a whole other thing going on that because of our mental obscurations, we can't see at all. Good to have a, you know, this kind of perspective sometimes. Okay, so it's saying that this, you know, that the Avalokiteshvara, okay, he's a superior because he's realized emptiness directly. So the word superior is the word Arya, as an Aryatara. Okay, or we talk about the Arya path. Yeah, or it's called the Four Noble Truths. The word noble is another translation of the word Arya. Okay, so it indicates somebody who's realized emptiness. And Avalokiteshvara Chenrezig, okay, is a bodhisattva because he's realized bodhicitta. So anytime he turns his mind to sentient beings, his instantaneous response is, I want to become a Buddha in order to benefit them. Okay, so very different from us. We look at some sentient being and we go, why in the world are they doing that? Why don't they do it this way? You know? So, but Avalokiteshvara looks at sentient being, instantaneous response is love and compassion. Okay, so it's called a bodhisattva. He's called a great being or mahasattva. These words come up in the Long Chenrezi Mantra. Yeah? So a great being or a mahasattva is because being a bodhisattva, he works with incredible courage and joy for the benefit of sentient beings. So somebody who works with that kind of skill and joy and perseverance and delight for sentient beings is called a great being. So actually, Avalokiteshvara is appearing as a bodhisattva here, but then there's another way of looking at him and saying, well, he also was enlightened many eons ago, but was just appearing as a bodhisattva because that was a skillful method in order to help ordinary sentient beings. You know how on the field of merit that we have, yeah? You have all the lineage lamas, you have the deities, you have Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Arhats and Pachacabuddhas and Dakas Dakinis and protectors. They're all, when we look at the field of merit like that, they are all emanations of the transcendental wisdom of bliss and emptiness of the minds of all the Buddhas, but appearing in all those different aspects, because that's a skillful way to appear to those of us who have no understanding of things. Okay? So that's why, you know, when you look at all these different deities, they aren't people with personalities, with solid concrete personalities. You know, they're manifestations, appearances of qualities. Okay, so now we're going to get into the explanation of the actual sutra, and that starts with the question of Shariputra. Okay, so it says, then through the power of the Buddha, so this is indicating that the Buddha's inspiring the whole thing. Okay, the Venerable Shariputra said to the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, how should a child of the lineage train who wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom? Okay, so Shariputra is like, you know, he's looking like he doesn't understand anything. You know, like, oh, how do you do this? But, I mean, why is Shariputra asking this question? It could be because he doesn't understand it. Or it could be because he understands it very well, but he realizes everybody else doesn't understand it. So he asks the question that everybody else is afraid to ask. You know, that happens sometimes in Dharma class. Everybody is thinking something, but one person finally, you know, has the nerve to ask it, even though everybody's wondering. Okay? And so the person who asks it could already know the answer. But they ask it for the benefit of other beings in order to create this discussion and get it out. So that's what Shariputra is doing. So we really have to thank Shariputra, don't we, for asking questions. Because if Shariputra didn't ask this question, we wouldn't have the Heart Sutra. Yeah? So we have to thank him for having the guts to ask a question to a bodhisattva. You know, he didn't sit there and go, oh, what's everybody going to think of me if I ask this question? I'm going to look like such an idiot. You know, he didn't have that. He just asked the question. Okay, so we really have to thank him. Okay, so he asks, how could a child of the lineage train? Okay, so a child of the lineage is referring to a bodhisattva. Okay, remember yesterday the people who took the bodhisattva vows, you became a child of the spiritual child of the Buddha, you became a child of the Buddha's lineage. Okay, so that's what the meaning is here, that you've joined, by generating the bodhicitta, you've entered into that family, that lineage of the Buddhas. So he's saying, like, once you've developed bodhicitta, how do you practice to develop the profound perfection of wisdom? Okay, so it's here the perfection of wisdom is referring more to emptiness than to the wisdom realizing emptiness, and it's called profound, and it's called the perfection of wisdom, and it's also called the object to be practiced. So it's profound because it's the deeper nature of existence, and it's also profound. Emptiness is profound because when we're able to realize it directly, then we can eliminate the ignorance and all the disturbing attitudes and this whole house of confusion that our mind has created falls apart. Okay? So that it's profound because it has a very far-reaching effect, beneficial effect. And it's called, here emptiness is called the perfection of wisdom because it's the object realized by the actual perfection of wisdom. And it's also called the object to be practiced because it's something that we've got to meditate on if we want to attain liberation. Okay. And that's real important to think, because sometimes it's like we want to attain liberation, but we look at emptiness and we say, I don't want to meditate on emptiness. It's too difficult, or it's too scary, or, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, to realize that this is the nature of reality, there's nothing to be scared of the nature of reality. You know, the thing to be scared of is our garbage mind. Nature of reality doesn't create problems. Our garbage mind does. Okay? So it's an object to be practiced, to pay attention to meditate on, to try and understand directly. Okay, so Shariputra is basically saying, how can somebody who's developed this bodhicitta, who has the primary focus, you know, the center piece of their whole entire life is to become a Buddha in order to benefit others, how do they engage in the profound practice to realize emptiness? Because it's emptiness that's going to free them from the disturbing attitudes and also from the subtle stains in the mind. And it's that realization of emptiness that's going to enable them to become a Buddha so that they can fulfill their wish of benefiting others most effectively. Okay, so Shariputra is asking a real important question here. Okay, thus he spoke, and then the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, replied to the venerable Shariputra as follows. So now Avalokiteshvara is in charge. He's being inspired by the Buddha to answer the question. And so the answer is, the initial answer here, let me see, is he's talking to the people who have lower faculties. In other words, the people who don't have a deep realization yet. And so he's going to be talking about how to practice the perfection of wisdom, how to develop this realization of emptiness according to the five Mahayana paths. Okay? So this sutra is divided into different sections talking about how you meditate on emptiness on each of the five Mahayana paths. So it might be helpful if we talked about what the word path means and what these five Mahayana paths are. So a path is a consciousness. Okay, path isn't a road that you practice. So when we talk about practicing the path or being on the path, it's not some external thing that we're practicing or external thing that we're on. But when we're practicing the path, it means that we're developing a consciousness that realizes emptiness. Okay, so a path is a kind of consciousness. So when we talk about the true path in the Four Noble Truths, the true path isn't some external teaching on following the path. There it is, you know. But it's the true path is the consciousness that realizes emptiness directly, that begins to cease all, you know, the various disturbing attitudes. So when we talk about the true path, we're talking about, you know, wisdom's realizing emptiness. Okay, so there also are mundane paths, you know. You can meditate on single-pointed concentration. A mundane path brings the mundane result. You get born in cyclic existence again. We're trying to practice transcendental paths to develop consciousnesses that realize emptiness that will transcend cyclic existence. Okay, so there's some paths that lead you back into samsara and some paths that lead you to nirvana. Also mean consciousnesses that lead us to an upper rebirth. So when we create virtue, yeah, those consciousnesses that are creating the virtue are paths. They're mundane paths because they lead to, you know, we haven't necessarily realized emptiness yet, and so they have a good result. We get a good rebirth, but we're still within cyclic existence. So even though they're virtuous, they're still called mundane paths. So the transcendental paths are the wisdoms realizing emptiness that are going to take us beyond cyclic existence. Okay, so now it starts. And it gives a brief explanation on how to practice the perfection of wisdom. In other words, how to generate the wisdom realizing emptiness on the paths of accumulation and the path of preparation. So let's just briefly talk about the five Mahayana paths. And these are very helpful to understand also when you meditate on refuge, because when we take refuge in the Sangha, yeah, we're taking refuge in beings who have attained a certain path. Yeah, when we take refuge in the Dharma, we're talking about the true path. So understanding these five paths can be really helpful when you're in your refuge practice as well. So also, sometimes we talk about the paths of the hearer, the five paths of the hearer, the five paths of the solitary realizer, and the five paths of the bodhisattva. So these paths have the same names, yeah, but they belong to different vehicles, because if you practice the hearer vehicle, you get the enlightenment, in quotes, of a hearer. Here, enlightenment means arhatship, okay? Means you are free from cyclic existence. You've eliminated the deluded obscurations on the mind. Okay? Or if you practice in the solitary realizer vehicle, then you become a solitary realizer. You get their enlightenment, which is also arhatship, which is liberation, freedom from cyclic existence. Okay? If you practice the five paths of the bodhisattva, or, you know, which is the bodhisattva vehicle, the Mahayana path, these lead you to the enlightenment of a bodhisattva, which is the full enlightenment. Okay? So the difference between an arhat and a Buddha is that an arhat has eliminated the deluded obscurations, so all the things that cause rebirth and samsara and cyclic existence, but they haven't yet removed the subtle stains on the mind. Whereas a Buddha has eliminated both sets of obscurations, the deluded obscurations that keep us trapped in cyclic existence, and the obscurations to omniscience, which are the subtle stains on the mind, which keep us from having an omniscient mind. Okay? So here we're talking about the bodhisattva vehicle, the Mahayana path. Yeah. I know this is very technical, but if you're going to follow a, you know, if you're going to go somewhere, you need a map. So we're learning the map here. Okay, we're going to get the layout of what we're going to practice one day. Whether we get to that in this lifetime or not, this is the layout. This is the map that we're going to go on. So it's helpful to know. Okay, otherwise we practice, we don't know where we're going. Okay, so
So these five, that when we go through these five paths, it's showing us where we're going. So talking about the Mahayana vehicle leading us to full enlightenment, first path is called the path of accumulation. You enter the path of accumulation when you have effortless bodhicitta. In other words, whenever you turn your mind to sentient beings, your first thought is, I want to free them, you know, I want to become a Buddha in order to free them from suffering. Okay? So that's the defining line of when you enter into the Mahayana path of accumulation. By that time, you also have realized complete renunciation or the determination to be free. Because the determination to be free is compassion for ourselves, wishing to liberate ourselves. Bodhicitta is based on compassion for others, wishing to liberate others. Okay, so that time when you've entered the Mahayana path of accumulation, you've realized, you know, you have a very stable realization of both the determination to be free and the bodhicitta. Okay, you have some understanding of emptiness, but you haven't necessarily realized it directly or anything yet. Okay. Now, the second path is called the path of preparation. Well, I should say the path of accumulation is so called because on it you accumulate a lot of positive potential and merit so that you can get to the path of preparation, which is the second path. The defining line of the Mahayana path of preparation is this bodhisattva when they are able in their meditation to have a special insight, which is a combination of special insight and calm abiding. Okay, or in Sanskrit words, shamatha and vipassana, okay, are put together in one mind on the object of emptiness. So the thing is that before that point, you may have calm abiding, you know, a single-pointed mind. But whenever you start to do some analysis, your concentration gets disturbed. Okay? Or you may do analysis, but you can't completely 100%, you can't stay single-pointed on what you're analyzing. So the analysis and the concentration are still rubbing, they still have a few rough edges, they can't go along real well together. You enter the path of preparation where your analysis strengthens your concentration. Okay? So you have the calm abiding and the special insight firmly together, where your analysis and concentration help each other, and you're focused on emptiness. So this is a pretty heavy-duty realization, I mean, because you have calm abiding, you have a correct understanding of emptiness. You haven't necessarily realized emptiness directly, though, because you can still have this special insight, this vipassana mind. But when you first realize emptiness, you don't see it directly, you see it through a mental image. Okay? So the difference between seeing something directly and seeing it through a mental image is, for example, if I look and I see the white on the wall, that's a direct perception, versus if I close my eyes and I remember what the white of the wall looks like, or I think of the color white. Okay? That's a mental image. Okay, so this bodhisattva path of preparation has a realization of emptiness, but it's not a direct one yet, because there's still the mental image there. There's the mental image of emptiness. But it's still fantastic, you know? Okay, now that person on the path of preparation is preparing, okay, it's called path of preparation, because they're preparing to gain the first moment of actually directly perceiving emptiness. Okay? So when you actually directly perceive emptiness, that's the demarcation when you enter the path of seeing. Okay? So the path of seeing is where you become an Arya, or a noble one, a superior one, because you have the direct realization of emptiness. So that's when you become a person who's the Sangha jewel, the Sangha that you take refuge in, because you've realized the nature of reality, you know, completely, directly, perfectly at that time. So you're a reliable object for other people to trust. You're not going to mislead them, you know, because you've seen emptiness directly. Okay? So it's called the path of seeing, clearly because you see emptiness directly for the first time. Okay? So that's the third path. The fourth path is called the path of meditation. Now, meditation, remember, comes from the same word as to familiarize or habituate. So on the path of meditation, what you're doing is you are familiarizing and habituating your mind with this direct perception of emptiness. And by doing so, you begin to cleanse your mind. So it's not the case that you realize emptiness and whammo bango, all your disturbing attitudes are gone in one shot. It's not like that. You have to keep meditating on emptiness over and over and over again, and you also have to keep accumulating positive potential or merit and get that going, yeah, so that you're deepening your realization of emptiness, even though it's still the direct one. You're gathering more positive potential. You're familiarizing your mind with all of this, and by that force, then you're able to start eliminating even the innate disturbing attitudes. So on the path of seeing, the intellectual or artificially created disturbing attitudes are eliminated. Those are the ones that we learn from wrong philosophies or wrong psychologies this lifetime. Those are eliminated, the path of seeing. The innate ones are eliminated on the path of meditation. Okay, because you're familiarizing yourself with the realization of emptiness. And you're still on the Mahayana path, okay, full bodhicitta here. When you've completely eliminated all the disturbing attitudes on your mind, okay, then you're partway through the path of meditation. You're what's called on the eighth bodhisattva level. You keep on meditating on the path of meditation to remove the subtle obscurations in the mind. When you've reached the point where you've eliminated all the subtle obscurations on your mind, then, you know, that at that point you attain the fifth path, which is the path of no more learning, and that's enlightenment, okay, the full enlightenment of the Buddha, and it's called the path of no more learning because there's nothing more to learn, okay, because you've got it all. So you might hear about these paths and go, wow, you know, this is so hard, this is so high. But when you look at it, you know, when we talk about the Buddha nature, the Buddha potential that we have the ability to do this. Okay, so we're not just studying here about five paths that all these super intelligent people, other people, practice and actualize. What we're talking about is what we ourselves have the potential to do. And it's very, very important to remember that, okay? Yeah? And don't underestimate, don't lock into some solid, rigid concept of ourselves. But remember that we have the potential to actualize all these things simply because we have a mind. The basic nature of the mind is such that as long as you have one, you have the Buddha potential. So even if you try and get rid of your Buddha potential, you're going to fail. Okay, so if you want to be a failure, the one way to be a failure is to try and get rid of your Buddha potential, because there's no way you can do that. Everything else you can't fail at. Yeah. Geshe Nawandarge, we'd go to him and we'd say, Geshe Lord, this is so hard, we can't do this. He'd look and he'd say, if you can become a Buddha, you can learn this. Yeah? Uh-huh. Fail. No, that's fall. Fail, F-A-I-L. Yeah, means like you can't do anything right. Oh, the only way you're ever going to fail is if you try and eliminate your Buddha nature. Because you can't eliminate your Buddha nature.
Oh,
yeah? Okay? But outside of that, there's nothing else you can fail on. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's when you start to eliminate the innate disturbing attitudes. That's the demarcation line. When, you know, you've finished eliminating the intellectual ones and you're starting now to eliminate the innate ones. That's the demarcation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And here we're talking about somebody who's entered the bodhisattva path directly. you know, because there's some people who first become arhats. They follow the hearer's solitary realizer path. They become arhats. They stay in their blissful concentration for a while. You know, then the Buddha comes and says, hey, there's other sentient beings. You've got some work to do. And so then they have to go from arhatship and they have to enter. They have to generate the bodhicitta. When they generate the bodhicitta, they start on the Mahayana path of accumulation. Now, they've already realized emptiness directly, but they still have to start on the first Mahayana path. Okay, the beings who have become arhats. So that's why our teachers encourage us, just go for, you know, if the end result is going to be Buddhahood, just go for the bodhisattva path to start with, if you can. You know, some people don't want to. It's more skillful for them to follow the hearer or pratyeka vehicle path first. But for those of us who have the karma with it, then it's kind of more efficient. And, you know, we're Americans. We like to be efficient, you know. Don't waste any time. Get to the point. Yeah, so points bodhicitta. So don't waste any time and develop it ASAP. Oh, because it's good to meditate on emptiness before, because your meditation on emptiness automatically helps your disturbing attitudes to decrease. Okay? So you want to develop all aspects of the path. You don't want to just, you know, I'm just meditating on bodhicitta and I'm not thinking at all about emptiness. Because if you meditate on emptiness, it actually helps your development of bodhicitta. Okay? Especially, you know how it helps is when even you haven't realized emptiness directly, if you can start to look at sentient beings and recognize that they are empty of inherent existence and that the whole reason they suffer is because they have this ignorance that clings on to inherent existence, then you begin to see that all the suffering of sentient beings is completely unnecessary. The only thing that's fueling it is the, you know, the ignorance and the disturbing attitudes and then the karma, you know. But it's like, this isn't the real nature of sentient beings. The ignorance that traps them isn't something that has to exist. It is, you know, ignorance doesn't perceive reality correctly. So therefore, all the sentient beings, it's like they're suffering uselessly. You know, they're only suffering because they don't understand emptiness. So if you understand emptiness, you begin to see this more clear, then that helps your compassion for sentient beings because you realize it's like they don't have to sit here and suffer. This is useless. This is senseless. It's only because they're under the influence of ignorance. So then your compassion gets really strong if, you know, I want to free them from this ignorance. Yeah, and to do that, I have to realize emptiness too. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Exactly. Right. Right. His Holiness talks about that actually a lot. That when you, you know, the better your understanding of emptiness is, the better, you know, the more you're going to have a determination to free yourself from cyclic existence, because you're going to realize that, you know, that there is an out. That, you know, life isn't just the first two noble truths. There's also the last two. Yeah. We get stuck in thinking, it's, you know, Buddha only taught two noble truths. He only taught suffering and its causes. We stop there, you know. We have to remember, you know, two and two is four. You know, that there are the last two. Okay? Yeah. And so there is a path. There are cessations, and we have to put some energy into them. Okay, so let's go on here. So, Shariputra, so Avalokiteshvara says to Shariputra, Shariputra, whatever son or daughter of the lineage wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom should look perfectly like this, subsequently looking perfectly and correctly at the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates also. Okay? So, here they mention son or daughter. Okay? You want to put that in yellow letters? Yeah? You all got your yellow pen? You put your yellow pen on daughter, not on son. Okay? Everybody happy? Okay. So why does it say he's looking at the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates also? Okay. So he's looking at the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates. Those are the aggregates of body and mind that compose us. Aggregates means heap or collection. So it's referring to the five aggregates that compose us. The word also, okay, means that he's looking at the emptiness of inherent existence of the self, of the I, capital I. Okay? So not just the emptiness of inherent existence of our body and mind, but the inherent existence of the person who is merely labeled on top of that body and mind. And it's the grasping at the inherent existence of the person that is our biggest problem. Okay? Because we make ourself such a big deal. Okay? He's looking at the inherent... This. No, he's saying like this, and then how you should look is subsequently looking perfectly and correctly at the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates also. Okay? So you want to look perfectly at the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates and of the self. The self or I. Okay? Now, when we meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence of the I, that's called the selflessness of persons. When we meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence of the aggregates, that's called the selflessness of phenomena. Okay? Phenomena here meaning everything that isn't a person. Okay? Because we often divide selflessness into two. That of the person, so the emptiness of the person, or the selflessness of phenomena, which is everything else, including the five aggregates. Okay? And we're going to get into the meaning of emptiness and here in existence soon, don't worry. Okay, when it talks about subsequently looking perfectly and correctly, okay, the word subsequently is indicating that when you first realize emptiness, you do it via an inference. Okay, so actually there's a whole way that we go from having a wrong conception to a direct perception of emptiness, and it goes through stages, and we have to go through all the stages. So we start out with a wrong conception. We think everything's inherently existent. The first step is to begin to doubt that. Okay, so this kind of doubt is actually good. Because it's the kind of doubt that's saying, maybe my ignorance is ignorant. Okay? Maybe things really aren't inherently existent like I think they are. Okay? So that doubt is a step up from the wrong conception. So then with the doubt, we begin to study, we explore, we learn, we think about things. We come to what's called a correct assumption. Okay, so here we have the general idea of emptiness, and it's a correct one, but somehow we don't quite get it yet. Okay, so it's a correct assumption, but it's not a deep understanding. We keep on studying, we keep on meditating, we keep on debating and discussing these things. Then what happens, the next step, is we get to an inference. Okay, an inference is incontrovertible. In other words, it understands that object the way the object is. It's not erroneous in its understanding of the object. Okay? So an inference is when you have like a syllogism, like in this case, we'll start out with form. You know, form is not inherently existent because it's a dependent arising. Okay? So it's inference because you understand that syllogism. Not just some kind of correct assumption because you kind of got it, but you've actually thought about it deeply. And it's called, an inference is called subsequent. I mean, the word subsequently here is referring to inference because you have an inference subsequent or after you've really understood the different parts of the syllogism. So if you have, you know, form is empty of inherent existence because it's a dependent arising, you've understood that form is a dependent arising. That's called the reason. And you've also understood that if it's a dependent arising, it's empty of inherent existence. That's called the pervasion. Yeah? So when you've meditated, you've really understood all that. Then, because you've understood the reason, the pervasion, you get all this, then, subsequent to that, then you have the inference. Okay? So the inference, after that, you're never going to waver, you know, because your mind is just sure. People can say this, they can say that. You don't listen because you got it. Okay? And so, at that point, your understanding is really good. Yeah? You still are perceiving emptiness through that mental image. Okay? So an inference is a conceptual understanding. It's not a direct perception. Okay? Now, we keep on meditating on emptiness and accumulating merit, and by that, what happens is that this veil of the mental image through which we're realizing emptiness, instead of just perceiving the mental image of emptiness, we're now going to perceive emptiness directly. And so we've gone to a direct perception. So you see, we started out with wrong view, you know, with misconception. We went to doubt. Then we went to correct assumption. Then we went to inference. Then we went to direct perception. So this is how we do it. Yeah? Yeah. We start out with wrong, with misconception. Everything's inherently existent. Then we go to doubt. Oh, maybe things aren't inherently existent. Then we go to correct assumption. Yeah, things aren't inherently existent. You know, but things aren't real clear. Then we go to inference. I got it. You know, things are not inherently existent because they're dependent arising. Okay. Then you go to direct perception where you actually see emptiness directly. Okay. So at that point, the direct perception, you see the lack of inherent existence directly, not through the veil of a mental image. Right. Yeah. Which is why we spend so much time purifying the mind and accumulating merit. You see how important they are? Okay. So, you know, this direct perception is what we're aiming at, but we get to it via an inference. So this is actually quite helpful to know, isn't it? Yeah. Because then we know that when we begin to have doubts, you know, actually sometimes it can be really good, can't it? And then we also don't expect ourselves to have a direct perception because we know that we're still kind of trying to get a correct assumption, you know. We're still working on it. So let's not expect ourselves to have a direct perception yet. Okay? So it's real helpful to kind of know these stages because then we realize it's a whole process that you go through and we don't start having, you know, high miraculous expectations. But, you know, instead we build up a lot of courage to go through this process, knowing that, you know, you do get to an end. Okay? We've run out of time. Actually, I want to talk about something else. Because I would like to make this a complete teaching, and so we got to keep going. Okay, so the inference that we're developing, or that Avalokiteshvara is talking about here, okay, there's three kinds of inferences that realize emptiness, and they kind of go in progression. Okay, so the first is the wisdom. So here we're talking about an inferential wisdom that realizes emptiness that arises from hearing. Okay, so at this point, the inference that realizes emptiness is your own realization, but it depends principally on the reasons that were said and established by other people. Okay? So it could be when you come, you know, you go to teachings and you hear all the reasons proving emptiness in the teachings. So the reasons are, you know, being established by somebody else, and it's creating an inference in your mind, and that's good, you know. But you're really, it's kind of like the first level, because it's other people are explaining it to you. Okay? The next step is to have the wisdom or the inferential wisdom that arises from contemplation or from thinking. And so at this point, you are, after you've realized emptiness by hearing, and you've heard the reasons established by others, okay, you go back and you start thinking about it yourself. So the wisdom that arises due to your own thinking about it and discussing it with other people, that's the wisdom that arises from contemplation, from thinking. So that's the next step. Okay. Then, with that, then you sit down and meditate. And, you know, and you really go deep. And the wisdom arising from meditation is coming when you have the union of special insight, calm abiding and special insight. Okay? So at that point, you're meditating. You know, you started out with the reasons established from others. Then you understood it through reasons that you established through yourself and your own reflection. Now you're really meditating, and you're getting your calm abiding, your single-pointed mind, and your analytical mind completely together on that point, you know, so that you realize emptiness for yourself, you know, with that inference. And so that's when the wisdom of arising from meditation starts. Okay, so this again is showing us why it's so important to listen to teachings. Okay, because that first wisdom, the wisdom that arises from hearing, is the wisdom that comes from listening to teachings, from studying, you know, from learning things. Because, you know, sometimes if we think all we have to do is sit down and meditate, we're not going to know what in the world to meditate on. You meditate on emptiness. What does that mean? Make my mind blank. Well, congratulations, you become a cow. You know? I mean, we've got to understand what emptiness means. It's not just a word that we develop a definition for. We have to know what it really means. So to do that, we have to hear the teachings. Okay? Then we have to go back and think about them. Then we meditate on them. Okay? So it's really pointing to that three-step process. Which again, I think is really helpful for us to know, because it's showing us how to start and how to progress. You know, and that we don't just sit down and hear a few words and go into samadhi, you know. The path doesn't work like that unless, okay, a few people have incredibly good imprints from past lives. So if you are one of those, you know, stars in the daytime, who for, you know, I don't know how many thousands of lifetimes before have heard teachings and meditated and accumulated merit. Those people, maybe they hear one or two words, they hear the word emptiness, and the correct understanding of emptiness arises in their mind from hearing the word. But that's because they've done a lot of work in their previous lives. Okay. For the rest of us, we shouldn't really expect that to happen. Okay. So it's a gradual path. What we're doing is we're, by studying and putting some energy now, we're creating the cause so sometime in the future we're going to be the guy who hears emptiness and we're going to go, doing, you know, I got it now. Okay? But until we get to the doing part, we got to, you know. Okay? But I find this all very affirming, because it's really showing, you know, that us that there's a method. And it's step by step, and you do this, and then you do this, and you do this, and it's just, it's laid out, you know, it shows us how to do it, and so that eliminates all sorts of fanciful expectations and preconceptions. And then we also see, you know, how you just have to, you know, sit down and do this. I mean, because when the Buddha's teaching this, the Buddha's just telling us what he did himself. Okay? I mean, you want to talk about, you know how people get on TV and they tell their whole life story, all their personal intimate details on Geraldo? You know, what Buddha's doing is, this is what he's doing when he's talking in the Heart Sutra. Okay? He's just telling you what's going on in his mind. I think he should go on Geraldo. It probably protects the country a lot more. You know? But really, you know, we go, well, what is it? What does the Buddha think about all day? This is what the Buddha thinks about all day. Okay? So if you want a Buddha or a Bodhisattva to open up and tell you their deepest, darkest, emotional whatever is going on, this is it. Okay? And it's beautiful, isn't it? Okay, so it's basically showing us how to generate that same path, and you know, how to transform our mind into those path consciousnesses. Okay, so this is kind of the brief explanation of how you're meditating on the path of accumulation and the path of wisdom, where your understanding of emptiness is still via inference, so it's still a conceptual understanding of emptiness. Preparation. Yeah, still conceptual understanding. Okay, so that's as far as we're going to get today. Tomorrow we're going to start on the extensive explanation of how to practice the perfection of wisdom on the path of accumulation and the path of preparation. And here we're going to really get into the good stuff. Okay? So, please think about what's said. Please review your notes. Okay, because we only have 5 days to go through this, so I can't do a lot of review, because otherwise we won't get through the text, and we have completion complex here, so we want to complete it. So, you know, try and review your notes and think about this. And if you don't understand everything, it's okay. Yeah? Because just even thinking about this is beginning to shake the mind a little bit and make you start thinking in a new direction. So that's very, very good. Mm-hmm. Okay, in that first verse, that praise the Tatara, there it's talking about the teachers who haven't gotten this far on the path. Okay, because I mean, once you've reached the Arya stage, you're a completely reliable teacher. Even if you have genuine bodhicitta, you know, and you're on the path of accumulation, you may not have realized emptiness yet, but you're still going to be pretty reliable because your basic concern is for the welfare of others. And so if you're really concerned about the welfare of others, if your students, you know, need teachings that you're not qualified to give, you're going to send them to somebody else who is qualified to give them. And you're not going to make up answers just to fool people and make them give you offerings or give you respect. So in the Tara praise, where it's talking about that, you know, teachers who make up things and aren't reliable, it's talking about people like me, you know, who kind of, you know, don't have any understanding, but they come and go blah, 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 and all their garbage gets mixed in, okay? And you can also see that, I mean, there's people out there, it's such a spiritual supermarket in America now. And all these people, you know, they go to one Dharma course and they start teaching something, yeah? So, I mean, that's why it's real important to check the qualifications of the teacher and choose our teachers wisely. Okay, because not everybody who has the title of a teacher has realizations or even correct understanding. You know, people can be teachers and not even have a correct assumption. Okay, so that's why it's saying that Tara is our real refuge, because Tara is the perfection of wisdom. Okay, Tara is that mind that realizes emptiness directly. That's never going to deceive us. Okay?